ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
It hardly seemed possible a year ago, but does Europe, does the world need to start preparing for war?
The Polish Prime Minister, Donald Tusk, certainly seems to think so. He's drawing parallels between now and pre-war 1939.
Now, if that's true, it requires a big response. Yet some leaders wonder, do their citizens agree? Or do cost of living concerns trump everything else?
I'm Hamish McDonald.
I'm Geraldine Doog, and this is Global Roaming. Yes, now, Hamish, we certainly are talking about war, which I was worried about at the start of the year that we'd be overemphasising it. But really, we couldn't ignore Donald Tusk, you know, a big old pro that, as he is, naming it.
Yeah, and in many ways, today's episode is a bit of a how-to guide on how not to be scared and overwhelmed by it. So we are kind of thinking a little bit about, you know, the tendency towards panic and fear around these things. And I think Donald Tusk was also thinking about that, because everything that he said about 1939 and this being a pre-war era, he said, I don't want to scare or alarm people unnecessarily. If the name Donald Tusk rings a bell, it's because he's actually just come back as Polish Prime Minister after a period out of office. A lot's happened in Poland. It's really been at the vanguard of sort of the push towards the hard right, maybe even the far right. Politically, it's obviously on the border with Ukraine and Russia, and is confronting some of these issues in a very serious way. And of course, suddenly, you know, war is on the doorstep physically for Poland. But he's issuing a call to the rest of Europe, the rest of the world, to think deeply about what all of this means.
Well, he says, in effect, forewarned is forearmed. That's his point. He's basically even said, I don't want to frighten people, but I want to warn them, which, of course, is what Churchill used to say in 35, 36, 37, you know. And so that's what Tusk is saying. Will everybody please sort of sit up and take notice? This is not going away. Europe could be entering a new era.
So what prompted this speech, it seems, is a missile straying into Polish airspace from Russia, it seems. And he's invoked 1939 with his own personal story. He talks about this photograph of his grandparents. His family had direct experience, obviously, of the Nazi invasion. His grandfather was forced to work in a concentration camp. He's got personal history with this. And he's reminding people on the continent to consider what might happen next. You know, there's long been this idea that Putin would never stop at Ukraine if he got even part of his way.
Look, I find this so interesting. Sitting here in Australia particularly, do we think, oh, look, that is the old world. We don't have to think about that because we're a long way from all of those collection of cultures with all of those terrible memories. A lot of people, of course, came here to escape those memories. But, you know, it is quite a challenge for us in the Southern Hemisphere to say, do those sorts of Northern Hemisphere preoccupations need to bother us at all?
Well, I think they do, because obviously we're subject to the great power competition that's unfolding around the world. And wherever a major conflict is, it absorbs the focus, the attention, the bandwidth, the military capabilities of great powers like the United States, for example. You know, we see that now with the question of arming Ukraine. But we also observe this in the context of other conflicts, like what is unfolding not just between Israel and Hamas, but also more broadly across the Middle East. And don't forget this week, strike conducted on Syrian soil. It looks like it was the Israelis, though they have not said anything, of course, on the Iranian consulate there in Damascus. It took out three Iranian Revolutionary Guard commanders, so senior figures. So this concept of a broader regional conflagration is very real. And then, you know, closer to home for us is the question of China and the South China Seas and who has sort of control or sway in the Asia Pacific region. So I do think it impacts us in perhaps a way that is more real and more present than we might like to imagine.
Oh, look, it's so challenging. I just think a lot of us thought that particular type of conflict was over. You know, we can remember the Cuban Missile Crisis. We know that it's not as if the world sort of goes along in a gorgeous little stasis. But
sorry, when was that? I don't know if I do remember.
No, you don't remember the Cuban Missile Crisis. Oh, look, he's having his little go. Oh, well, I won't reveal how old I was. so I remember it. Anyway, in order to put all of this in context, maybe we should introduce you to our guest. I think he's someone who can draw together all these big shifts that we're talking about. Ian Bremmer is the founder of the political risk consultancy Eurasia Group and the media company G-Zero, and he studies geopolitical shifts. He helps everybody, I think, from politicians to ordinary punters make sense of them. I mean, he's a real Washington Beltway man, isn't he?
It's an unbelievable CV and record when you read it. But the point is, for the purposes of this episode, this is a man that people in power listen to when it comes to thinking about what the world is confronting and might confront.
Yeah, and he loves distilling it. And I think you will too. So let's welcome him.
Ian Bremmer, welcome to Global Roaming.
Happy to be with you.
It's an incredible mix of different things you do. When you're at a dinner party, how do you explain it?
I honestly dislike it when people read the bio, right? Because it's long and it's pretentious. But really, it's about the human connection. It's about, you know, people are getting, they're getting angry, they're getting confused, and they're getting scared by what's happening in the world today, not necessarily in that order. And I think we're trying to help them make sense of it. And people can be scared of things that they don't understand. And if they understand it a little better, especially in a way that doesn't make them angry, that isn't about what political side you're on, but something, you know, deeper than that, I think then we've done something.
Well, that's interesting because, for instance, Donald Tusk, the Poland's newly re-elected prime minister, he is evoking 1939 and the build-up to the Second World War and saying we might be in another pre-war state. Now, do you share that view?
Well, first of all, it's easier to have that view in Poland, right? I mean, they're on the front line. Their government is likely to spend 4% of their GDP on defense in 2024. And they worry that if Ukraine loses, Poland is right there. So, I mean, it may well feel like Poland is in a pre-war state in a way that if you're in Australia, I mean, I read On the Beach by Neville Shute. I mean, you're the last place people go after the nukes go off, right? So it is certainly plausible. I was with my friend Yuval Noah Harari, who wrote the book Sapiens and Homo Deus, the Israeli philosopher, historian. And he said it's possible that, you know, we could already be in World War III and not know it. And his point, of course, is that if you go back to the late 30s, you know, the history books will tell you World War II was already started. But the United States certainly didn't think that at the time. So that's interesting. And there are a lot of things that are going badly. I think that it is absolutely true that the geopolitical environment today is objectively more dangerous than certainly anything we've seen since the wall has come down in 1989. We've got, you know, three major wars going on. We have the Russians in Ukraine. That war is not going well from the perspective of the U.S., Australia, other democracies. We've got Israel and Gaza. That war is not going well from the perspective of the U.S., Australia, democracies. And then we have the United States versus itself, which is less violent than those two, but is equally dysfunctional. And that's not going well either in this election. And any year since 89, one of those things would have been sufficient to make us stand up and pay attention geopolitically. And we presently have all three going on. There are good things that are going on, too, that don't get the headlines. But those three negative things are large and problematic.
Do you see particular leaders, whether it's in Europe, whether it's broader than that, that are actually ready, willing, maybe even capable of standing up and preventing this turning into something worse?
I think Ursula von der Leyen in the European Commission is certainly trying to do that. I think of my good friend Antonio Guterres, the Secretary General of the UN, and the work he's done to try to reduce hunger through the Black Sea Initiative, negotiating with the Ukrainians and Russians together, even while they're fighting a war. So yes, of course, I think there are individuals that are playing that role, but most of the leaders of countries around the world today that we see are either weak or unwilling or both. And that is a serious problem.
That's a bit depressing, isn't it?
And you know...
Well, I started with the good stuff, it ended a bit dour, yeah.
Well, why is that so? I suppose, you know, you travel to Europe a lot, and it's a fascinating set of different cultures, with different mood in different cultures. I heard a terrific description the other day, they do not brood over the same nightmares in different parts of Europe. So, I mean, how do you read the mood in this mosaic, and I suppose the leaders that produces?
Well, the reason I mentioned von der Leyen when I talked about leaders that are doing a good job, and I would add Christine Lagarde, who runs the European Central Bank, to that group easily, is that in the context of a lot of things that haven't gone so well globally, and I'm thinking about, you know, the pandemic, I'm thinking about the Russian invasion of Ukraine. I'm thinking about the potential of a very dysfunctional U.S. 2024 election. The response of Europe has been to be stronger, has been we need a more capable European Union, the world's largest common market, to be able to better respond to these challenges. When the Russians invaded Ukraine, you saw the Europeans responding quickly to coordinate on transitioning their energy from Russian gas to greater efficiency, reduced waste, and anything else they could get their hands on to ensure that the European people would be able to get through this shock. And they've done it very well, very quickly, even though the prices have gone up for them. And the same thing is true with the efforts to put together a European defense commissioner, because they recognize that if Trump becomes president, the pressure on the Europeans to spend more is going to go way up. And even if Biden's unable to get $60 billion for the Ukrainians, Europe has to do more. So, yes, I think that there are lots of different stories inside Europe, but it turns out that Europe has a supranational governance capability, which is growing because it's necessary for it to grow. And that has been a positive story.
But isn't there part of that example also, which goes to Geraldine's question about mood amongst the populace, in that there are elections about to happen in Europe, and it may be that the far right really does snare a lot more seats than it has previously, and that it sort of tilts the balance in the European Parliament, and it may not be able to pursue these supranational approaches that you're describing? It might perhaps hobble Ursula von der Leyen if she gets her second term.
First of all, you clearly want me to go more negative, and so I guess I can do that. There are going to be parliamentary elections. They are most likely to return, more seats for far-right wing parliamentarians, maybe some more seats for far-left wing parliamentarians too, depending on the country. But overall, the existing coalition of governance for the European Parliament is likely to be the same. And von der Leyen is likely to be returned with a centrist, center-right coalition. And so that implies a level of stability at the EU, even as Macron is underwater today vis-a-vis Marine Le Pen. Mm. And, Scholz's party in Germany is presently polling worse, the Alternatives for Deutschland. So at the individual country level, these challenges are growing. At the EU level, in part because of the reduced governance and weakness of many of these individual European leaders. It's not France versus Germany. It's a whole bunch of countries that can't get it done and the EU becoming stronger.
Yeah, that's very, I suppose what it boils down to, as people have written, will the average European taxpayer say, hey, Donald Tusk is right. We really have got some fears coming and we might have to pay more or have less welfare in order to have a decent army. We haven't thought about this for, decades. We'd better do it. I think that's what he's saying. Is the average European citizen ready to start having this conversation?
Well, there your nightmares are important because the average Pole has a nightmare about the Russians. The average Balt, the average Nordic citizen, they have nightmares about the Russians and they already pay a lot more in defense. The average Portuguese does not. The average Spaniard does not. The average Canadian, by the way, does not. I was bemused when Trump was saying, hey, if you're not paying 2% GDP, the Russians can do whatever they want for defense. The Russians can do whatever the hell they want to you. And I'm like, well, you can say that, But all the countries that the Russians could plausibly do whatever the hell they want to are already spending much more than that. I mean, like, if Trump is saying that the Russians can do whatever the hell they want to Newfoundland because the Canadians are only paying 1.3%, that's not very credible, right?
Ian, I'm noting that, you know, you're niggling us for wanting you to go negative, but you said 2024 is the Voldemort of years, the Annus Horribilis.
Well, I mean, I did already mention that we have these three really major conflicts. That was it. And I mean, particularly the fact that the world's largest, most powerful, largest economically, most powerful democracy is by far the most politically dysfunctional.
Actually, can I just come in? That phrase, I've noted it down, that we've got one of the three wars is the US war against itself. Now, that's a very powerful phrase, I must say. I haven't.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
That's how you see it at the moment, is it?
Well, I think that it's not a civil war, of course, but I do think that one thing that unites my fellow countrymen and women and strongly unites them is that we all pretty much believe that the other political side wants to destroy democracy. Now, we can't all be right. In fact, we're probably all wrong, because I know lots of Americans that support Trump and lots of Americans that hate Trump, and none of them actually want to destroy democracy. But truly, most Americans, if you support Trump, you think that the Biden types want to destroy democracy. And if you are anti-MAGA, you're Biden, you think that the MAGA guys all want to destroy democracy. That is not a great position for your ostensible democracy to be sitting in an election year. By the way, the longest, most expensive, most dysfunctional election year that any of us have experienced in a major democracy.
Yes. And I mean, you said also that the people in Europe watching this have a sort of underlying panic about this. Now, is that changing attitudes in Europe, just watching this saga that you've described?
It is. They're very worried. They're worried. I mean, broadly, American allies around the world are worried because they're not sure how much they can trust a United States to follow through on commitments. You know, Obama says he's going to do the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and then he falls off, and then you do the Paris Climate Accord, and then the U.S. pulls out of it, and you're in the World Health Organization, there's a pandemic, and then probably a bad time for Trump to say, no, I'm not in that anymore. You've got the JCPOA, the Iranian nuclear deal, and then the Americans say, no, we're not doing it, and then Biden says, we're going to support Ukraine for as long as it takes. As well, no, we're not really. I mean, I can go on and on and on. I mean, the fact that the United States is so divided politically and is the most powerful country makes allies around the world worry that they shouldn't cozy up to the United States because a deal that you make will not stay in place when the politics change or when it's no longer convenient. I mean, even Afghanistan, the longest war the Americans ever fought, and first time that Article 5 was ever used in NATO and asked American allies to fight with the United States after 9/11, shoulder to shoulder, and every country, including a lot that weren't in NATO, like Australia, send troops to fight and to die next to Americans. And then 20 years later, the U.S. pulls out of Afghanistan and does it unilaterally, doesn't ask their allies to come to a collective decision. You know, that doesn't go over well. But that's the broader point. The narrower point for the Europeans is that the Russians invaded Ukraine, and they worry, rightly in my view, that if Trump becomes president, he just met with Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban in Mar-a-Lago a few weeks ago and told Orban that if he becomes president, if Trump becomes president, not one more penny of aid to Ukraine, which means the war is over because the Ukrainians will have to sue for peace except a ceasefire. Now, that is completely acceptable to Orban, but it's completely unacceptable to Tusk, as you mentioned at the beginning, and to a lot of other European countries. And yes, a lot of European countries, including France's President Macron, are panicked about that. Absolutely panicked about it.
I'm interested in these observations from our perspective here in Australia, because we often talk about, well, what happens with AUKUS, you know, if Donald Trump is re-elected? That list that you just rattled off does make me think, well, are we acting a bit blind here? Because across our political spectrum, there's quite a lot of consensus that it'll be fine. You know, Trump won't threaten AUKUS. Do you see it that way?
Yeah, I think that the Asian allies have less of a problem on this front. Trump is talking about a 60% across the board tariff on Chinese exports. And certainly he and Bob Lighthizer, the likely Secretary of Treasury under a Trump administration, are focused on having a much, much more hawkish policy on China, which means a more aligned policy with principal U.S. allies in Asia. And so I do believe that Australia, New Zealand, Japan, South Korea, India have less to worry about with a Trump administration than the Europeans will.
Can I just come back to something that dramatic sort of exposition by Trump to Orban? I just wonder how you think the American people will judge that, because, you know, I wouldn't have thought they actually wanted to hear that, but I'm very keen to sort of to gauge your view of your fellow citizens at the moment.
Support for Ukraine was very high after February 24th, 2022, and the initial Russian invasion. The U.S., of course, does root for an underdog. And Ukraine, once they started fighting courageously, despite the fact that they're a much smaller economy, much smaller population, March Madness is going on right now in the U.S., the college basketball tournament. And Americans love it when 11 seed North Carolina State makes it into the Final Four. That's very exciting. They root for them. That's kind of, you know, like the Ukrainians, this chippy little democracy that's trying to make a difference. But as the war goes on and it costs more money and the Ukrainians aren't fighting as well and they're starting to lose territory, Americans are losing interest. And it is true, as Trump says, no new wars under Trump. And that is, whether or not you think he's responsible for that, that has been a powerful line that he and his team have come back to and repeated on and on, because the average American does not believe that they benefit from extended American involvement in wars, whether they are directly sending troops or just helping to fund them. They don't believe that they benefit. Now, it is true that most of the money spent on the Ukrainian war is going to the American military-industrial complex, which provides jobs and is part of the, you know, U.S. stock exchange. Now, that's all true. But still, the average American feels like elites benefit from that, like shareholders benefit from that. But that ultimately, whether it's their sons and daughters that are being sent to fight in Iraq and Afghanistan and come back in pieces psychologically or worse, and whether it's their tax dollars that are being spent, but they're not the ones that benefit, they view themselves as being treated as cannon fodder for decades now by the political establishment in the United States. And they don't believe in their political institutions or their leaders. So if you get someone like Trump that says no more wars and I'm willing to attack these guys, I'm going to break them, and they hate me so much that they want to send me to jail, even though some of the reasons they want to send him to jail is because he's done some stuff that's clearly illegal, a lot of people will support that. And I do believe that's why the level of support for Trump is not only pretty high, consistently in the mid-30s in terms of the true loyalty, but also it's so visceral. It's so strong. It lends itself to bumper stickers and yard signs in a way that support for Biden does not.
Do you think he'll win?
I have very low confidence right now in who's going to win. We're half a year away. I mean, just the life expectancies of the two men at 81 and 77. I mean, one of them may not be with us in another 6 months. So that you've got that. But I mean, beyond that, I think in a world where you have a war in Russia, Ukraine, a war in the Middle East, where the U.S. elections are so politicized and such a target, both domestic and internationally, I suspect there are going to be a lot of things that are going to happen between now and then that will surprise us. So if the election were today, I think Trump would win barely. And third-party candidates matter a lot there because they take more from Biden than Trump, at least as of right now. But I'd only be at 60% Trump. And I would have very low confidence. So I don't feel strongly about that call right now.
You actually coined the term America First, as I understand it. You were describing Trump's foreign policy at the time, but he then, as I read it, loved it so much that he took it on for himself and ran with it. If you were to try and come up with a new term to characterize what you think he'll do in a second term, what's the new slogan?
So the term was originally, it came up from Charles Lindbergh and to try to prevent the Americans from getting involved in World War II, which of course was very unpopular pre-Pearl Harbor and was generally successful. And it was when the New York Times was about to interview Trump as a then candidate on his foreign policy, David Sanger, Maggie Haberman, and they were asking me in prep for that, was he an isolationist? And I said, no, I think his policy really is much more unilateral and America first. And they then asked Trump if he was an isolationist. He said, no. And they said, do you think you're America first? And he got very excited about that because he had never heard of Lindbergh. He's like, yeah, America first. And I was like, oh my God, what have I done? Like, that was not my intention to coin Trump's slogan. Look, he still plays by this. I mean, make America great again is kind of stupid, and I don't think he's going to use that. But I do believe that the big difference between Trump this time around and Trump first time is that if Trump loses, he's going to jail. The stakes for him are much higher. So this time around, his top priority will be stopping all of those investigations and using his political power to go after the people that, in his view, unjustly are trying to throw him in jail. And that means politicizing the Department of Justice, the IRS, the FBI. It means a new McCarthyism. I think that will be the top priority for a President Trump. And that is a very different story from what we all experienced in 2017.
So maybe by way of concluding then, if you are evaluating risk and basically sort of advising people on risk, I mean, obviously you just articulated a huge risk there. How do people who are thoughtful in the US prepare themselves for this?
Well, first of all, people need to understand that Trump can win. And they need to understand that Trump winning does not mean the U.S. becomes a dictatorship, does not mean a civil war, but it does mean that rule of law will take a serious structural and perhaps permanent hit. The U.S. today is the only wealthy democracy in the world that is incapable of holding a free and fair election that all of its population believes in. That's a real problem. Mm. That's a serious problem. It's kind of foundational.
Ian, is there anything, when you look around the world, is there much giving you optimism?
Well, we talked about it already. I talked about Europe. The AI revolution gives me incredible hope. I've never seen a technology that is so transformative in the hands of potentially billions of people in very short order around the world. And it's not being stopped, even though it's disruptive by, you know, actors that will be disrupted by it. I mean, you know, we couldn't deal with climate change for decades because coal companies didn't want us to deal with climate change. They preferred us investing in dirty coal. But, you know, when I look at AI, which is much more transformative as a technology, it is happening and it's happening. It's going to drive a new wave of globalization. I'm very excited about that. But the geopolitics, which happens to be my field of expertise, right now is pretty dangerous.
So if you imagine us and all of our global roaming listeners as clients, as people that you give advice to, what would you say to us in this corner of the planet? What should we be ready for? How should we be?
Down here.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, look, I spend a lot of time with Australians. I mean, Kevin Rudd, don't hold this against me. He's one of my best friends.
Really? No one ever says that about Kevin Rudd.
Oh. I know, but we're really close. In the United States, he's actually, you know, he's not even recognized on the street because, you know, he's Australian. You guys are so far away. We go to basketball and baseball games, and it's a lot of fun.
You don't go to strip clubs with him?
That was a long time ago that he did that. Scores, wasn't it? Scores or something like that?
He told me
he went up in the polls after that happened.
He did.
It's quite something. It made me like your system more, by the way, because it means you don't take yourself that seriously. I hope that's still true.
It is, I think. Anyway, do go on.
No, look, when we usually talk, we talk a lot about China, of course, because the U.S. Relationship with China, to the extent that it gets much worse, I mean, Australia is going to hit by that. But as you've seen, it turns out the Chinese still want a good Shiraz, right? They still want a good spiny lobster. Their economy is not going that well, and they feel like they overplayed their hand with you guys. And they are the largest economy in Asia. They're the most powerful military in Asia. But ultimately, geopolitics aren't going so well for them. The economy isn't going so well for them. And in fact, the geopolitics in your part of the world, you know, looks increasingly like a bunch of countries that are worried that the Chinese bit off more than they could chew. And we see that with the South China Sea. We see it with AUKUS and now New Zealand and Japan wanting in. We see it with the Indians and the Quad. We see it with South Korea, Japan, the United States. Those are comforting developments, frankly. So, I mean, the world from Australia's perspective looks like a place maybe I should consider residency in.
We'll be ready to welcome you, should it all become too much.
I expect that to be true. Kevin told me he'd take care of that on the down low. You know what I'm saying?
He's a politician. Don't trust everything he says. Hey, Bremer, thank
you. Oh, come on.
Could you get rid of the beard, do you think, of Kevin?
The beard is cute. It makes him look a little like Santa. You know, and I'm telling him though, when he's wearing it winter here, it's summer down where you guys are. So I'm not sure that's credible.
Ian Bremer, thank you very much.
Bye bye.
Okay, sure. Cheers, guys.
Well, Geraldine, I'm waiting for the listener correspondence from the ambassador to Washington.
You just might be surprised what arrives. we'll wait and see.
Do you come out of that conversation, though, more worried or I suppose, calmer about what is unfolding?
Truthfully, calmer, actually, because of his sheer grasp of it. I like knowing that people in corridors that matter have got a sort of a grasp and a distillation like that. I did feel that what he said about the Asian region, he thought being a little bit more impervious to a lot of these shifts, was fascinating.
And perhaps faring a little better during a Trump presidency.
If he thought they might. I thought that was quite intriguing. But, you know, I wonder whether he's right. And we haven't heard much about this in Australia. And you want us to talk more about Trump, Hamish. So there you are.
I absolutely do. And I know it's been something kind of niggling away for us both this year. I mean, I do think it's important, particularly as journalists, not to shy away from the realities that are in front of us, and the prospect of a second Trump presidency is real. Now, you can accept Ian Bremer's version of things, that perhaps under Trump, because of the China dynamic, that countries like Australia, Japan may fare somewhat better, at least in comparison to Europe, because tactically Trump might see that as a valuable card in his pocket. But at the same time, I don't think we should be overly optimistic or blind to the realities of how transactional Trump might be.
I won't be overly optimistic. I promise you.
Sure. But I mean, I think we have to confront the fact that he may take a different view of the AUKUS arrangement, the bill for that. You know, it's still not settled.
Or we might just not matter to him, you know. That's the other possibility. Sure. We just won't matter enough.
But remember those initial phone calls with Malcolm Turnbull? There were big problems as a result of that. How might he respond to an Anthony Albanese as Prime Minister? I think that's all stuff that we will have to contemplate over the next few months lead up to an election.
No, it's all there. And of course, you know, he left me thinking it's very much a contest.
Jerry, recommendations, please.
Is it one. The American Fuhrer. It's on SBS On Demand. Very well done little doco about a man who posed as Hitler's emissary in America, and some extraordinary footage of huge Nuremberg-type rallies at Madison Square Gardens. A phenomenon I certainly didn't know about.
I'm going to recommend a podcast that I've been listening to and enjoying, Dark Shining Moment. It's called. It looks at the way Russia has used the internet and sort of internet warfare and disinformation to reshape, for example, the American election back in 2016, but just sort of alter perception and reality and stuff that we think about it a lot. But it's a forensic examination of this. It goes through the sort of Georgia-Russia conflict, if you remember that from 2008. It's dense, but if you are thinking about these issues and confusion, particularly in the lead-up to the next US election, it's really worth a listen.
Who's putting it together?
So it's called Ranieri & Co., which is an Australian podcasting company, but it's getting a lot of listens here and overseas as well.
Excellent. All right. Yes. Well, look, thank you for your time this week. It's been gorgeous to have you join us. And next week, we're delighted to welcome the newly appointed Executive Director of Human Rights Watch, Tarana Hassan, who is an Australian and is visiting Australia. Obviously, lots to talk about in this arena, but not all predictable, I might add.
Yeah, very unexpected, I think. So I'm looking forward to that conversation. Please keep your feedback coming, global.roaming@abc.net.au. If you want to find us on the ABC Listen app, search for Global Roaming inside it. When you find our page, hit the love heart. Everything should turn pink when it's switched on. That's how you know you'll get us every week. If you're listening elsewhere, please give us a follow, a star rating, a comment or a review. We really appreciate all of that. And you can catch our first ever live show. It's coming up at the Sydney Writers Festival on the 25th of May. We'll be discussing Australia's twin perils, the United States and China. That's it for this week, Jerry. Good to see you.
Good to see you. And our thanks to our marvellous producer, Taryn Priyadko, who makes this all possible. Bye-bye.
Goodbye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.